Well, hello there, everyone, and welcome to the Niche Optimizer Formula Teleclass. Good to be here. Great to have you guys here today. And I have a couple of housekeeping items before we get started with the material. I want to let you know that there is a PDF document. You should be seeing it there on the class page. It's called Class Notes. And what I've done is I've put together a kind of a summary of what we'll be covering, some of the key points, most of the key points, as well as the exercise that I'm going to walk you through at the end. So it's a pretty lengthy document, but I think, you know, a lot of you guys are like I am. I like to have something I can use to follow along and print out and have in front of me and take notes. It just becomes something that's more usable for me later. Once I'm kind of thinking through this stuff. So that's the first thing. Now, tomorrow, we're going to go ahead and post a second PDF to this page, which will also contain the replay, by the way. So if you have to leave, you can't catch the whole thing. If you got here late, doesn't matter. There's going to be a replay posted tomorrow or by tomorrow. And also tomorrow, I'm going to post the transcript. Now, I'm not calling it a transcript. Those of you who have taken some of my other training programs, you know that what I prefer to do whenever possible is give you a really clean version of a transcript. So it really reads more like an ebook. It's got subheads. It's got illustrations. It's a much more practical document, in my opinion. And that's going to be called the class workbook. So today what you see there is class notes. Again, I would encourage you to print it out, have it in front of you, and use it to take notes on. And then tomorrow you'll see the class workbook, which has, a cleaned up transcript, and it'll also contain the exercise at the end. So that's where the duplication is. It's with the exercise. So you may not really need to print both of them. I mean, if it were me, I would print out today's document and then tomorrow's document, the workbook. I would keep in digital form, store it in a folder somewhere, use it to refer to whatever, but you don't need to print out both because the exercise is in both documents. I just didn't want to have in one and not in the other. I thought it might be better to do it that way. The other point I wanted to make is that we're going to go longer than what I promised, and I hate to do that, but two things. I decided to add some bonus material at the end, which is, I think it's really going to benefit you. It's going to take your findings from this discovery process and allow you to turn it into more usable content and copy. And this is a logical next step. I didn't want to leave you hanging, so I wanted to add that material as well. And I also want to kind of take my time with this. I want to give you the best stuff possible. So I know I promised a 90-minute call. Typically when I do that, it's an hour of instruction and up to 30 minutes of Q&A. I think I'm probably going to go about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes of instruction. And then what I'll do, guys, is I'll be here as long as it takes to answer your questions. So, you know, if we need to go 2 full hours, we'll do that, up to 2 full hours. I don't think we will, but, you know, if we need to, that's fine. Listen, if you have to jump off again, know that you're going to get the recording, the replay, and you'll have lifetime access to that and to all the files. So I just wanted to warn you now in case you got to leave for an appointment and you're wondering when I'm going to wrap this thing up. So that's what it is. So, again, we'll do Q&A at the end. Hold your questions. As you think of them, go ahead and jot them down. And if you want to type them in, that's fine. Or if you want to wait till the end and type them in at that point in the question field, or if you want to raise your hand and ask them live on the phone, I'll show you how to do that as well. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started and make sure that everything is looking good. We're all good to go. All right, so this whole niche thing, you know, this is probably one of the biggest source of pain and anxiety for freelance writers. And I see it in both the new people and even established freelance writers who are trying to think about how they're going to reposition themselves and reinvent themselves. It's a different problem for each. I think for new or even aspiring freelancers, this niche quest tends to create a lot of confusion. I see it stall progress all the time. I see it killing momentum, and I see it just kill businesses. I mean, many people don't even get started because they get stumped by this whole niche question. And I think the biggest reason for newer people is because freelancers have been led to believe that they have to make a final decision on this issue before they get out there and go to market. And that's just not true. Now, don't get me wrong. Having a niche or a specific target market is a good idea, but it's not a prerequisite for launching your commercial writing business or your copy freelance copywriting business. Those who have been freelancing for a while, the more established people, have a different challenge with this whole niche thing. They're typically so close to their business, they've developed a blind spot of sorts. So the options aren't really very clear, and then the ideal scenario is often not on their radar screen. So what I'm going to do in this class is I'm going to give you a simple framework for determining if you should define a niche, how to find one that makes sense, and what to do if you can't come up with anything viable. Now, you really can't have a productive discussion about picking a niche without talking about positioning. In fact, positioning is what truly frames this whole niche discussion. I really believe that talking about finding a niche is in many ways counterproductive, in fact. And it's kind of funny because the whole time I've been talking about niche, but now I'm going to switch gears on you. I really think that it's more important to have a discussion about how you're going to position yourself in the market. So we're going to use positioning as our guide for making this important decision. Now, that term positioning does get thrown around quite a bit these days, and it tends to create some confusion. It sounds like the kind of term you normally hear used in corporate marketing. So let's define it. To me, positioning is about the perception you create in the prospect's mind. It's the perception that your prospect has about you and about your services when they come in contact with your marketing materials, your website, or just you in person, an in-person event. It's also about your uniqueness, your difference, what makes you different from most others, and why a prospect should care about that difference. A good way to start this positioning discussion is to talk about how three different companies position themselves, because in reality, there's really not that much difference between how a company creates perception and how you and I do the same thing. And yeah, the scale is greater with a big company, with a big brand, but the principles are the same. And some of you may have heard me talk about this before, but bear with me. Maybe if you've heard it before, now it will really sink in. So I'll give you three examples, the first one being the Ritz-Carlton hotels. And the Ritz-Carlton is just absolutely obsessed about every single detail about the customer and the customer's needs, the wants, the expectations. Everything they do in their hotels is about delighting their guests. They're not selling hotel rooms. They really believe that they're not in that business. They're selling a memory. They're selling an unforgettable experience. And one of the ways they do this is through unsurpassed service to every guest every single time, absolutely no exceptions. Now, you might think, well, you know, that's what everyone says. But you know what? If you've ever stayed at a Ritz-Carlton hotel, I've been fortunate enough to have stayed two or three times before, the difference is palpable. I mean, you could – every interaction you have with anybody at their hotels, whether it's the person checking you in to even the housekeeping or service, everyone is just absolutely amazing. They really take it seriously, and they even have a three steps of service, which they take to heart. Three steps are very simple. They deliver a warm and sincere greeting and use the guest names in the greeting. They anticipate and fulfill the needs of each guest, and they give a warm goodbye, again, using that guest names. And they really, I don't know how they do it, but it's amazing. They do remember you. You know, I've come in, I've checked in, gone to my room. An hour later, we're going out to dinner, my wife and I, and they greet us by name. I mean, it's just, it's quite remarkable. Again, this sounds simple, it sounds non-revolutionary, but the difference is very obvious when you stay there. They're very clear about who they are. They're very clear about how they serve their customers and what makes them different. They're not trying to please everyone. Notice that, right? They're just trying to please a small segment of travelers who really respond to that kind of positioning. Let's take a very different business, Trader Joe's, the grocery chain of Trader Joe's. For those of you in the U.S., they've been expanding, so you may have heard of it. You may have shopped at one before. They are one of the most profitable grocery store chains in the world. They actually sell twice as much per square foot as the average grocery store in the United States. And their secret, the combination of factors. One of the first things you'll notice when you shop there is they have a very smart assortment of innovative, hard-to-find, great-tasting foods. They have great prices, so this is really about value. They offer amazing value in their products. And they have no sales, they have no gimmicks, they have no clubs that you have to join in order to get special pricing, no special cards to swipe, nothing like that. It's the same price all the time. And they do this because they work with directly with contract manufacturers to produce their own foods. I think 80% of their products are their own brand, the Trader Joe's brand. And where the average grocery store has about 50,000 products, the average Trader Joe's carries only 5,000 products. So they're very, very strategic with their assortment. They are constantly monitoring their products, and they keep only their best-performing products. So every product they sell has to compete for that little bit of shelf space. It's not an impressive place when you go in there. It's bare bones, you know. But I tell you, you taste and try a few of their products, it's really, really fantastic stuff. You see a lot of cooks there. They carry a lot of organic products that's just standard. They might sell something. They only sell the organic version. And it's not any more expensive than a standard conventional equivalent at your average grocery store. So they're selling higher quality products at the same price, if not lower, than the branded equivalent. Now, here again, you're not going to find people who want the absolute cheapest food. That's not what they're about. You know, they're really catering to very savvy consumers who want real value. They want high quality at a good price. Let's take a different retailer, Walmart. Walmart is the world's largest retailer, and what are they about? Well, their tagline or their motto says it all: save money, live better. You know, they've kind of coined that phrase, everyday low prices. They pride themselves in being the absolute lowest cost retailer. They will never be undersold. They pride themselves in convenience because they're everywhere, and their stores are so large. They have a massive assortment of products. And, you know, for a lot of people, this is the place to go when you need something, just about anything, and you want to pay the absolute bare minimum. Now, what are you not going to get at Walmart? So you get the lowest cost price guaranteed. You're not going to get great customer service. It's not going to be an easy experience in terms of getting in and out of the store. These stores are so massive. And, you know, finding someone to help you, where can I find, you know, tools or whatever. It's very difficult to find someone to help you even locate what you need. And it's not going to be necessarily a memorable shopping experience. But, again, they're not trying to be everything to everybody. They're very, very clear about their value proposition. They're very clear about the perception they create in their customers' mind. None of these three businesses is better than the other. You know, it's not about that. My point is that each of these companies has done an amazing job of positioning themselves for huge success. And they're crystal clear about who they are, what they do, whom they serve, what makes them different. They don't try to be all things to all people. They instead take pride in serving a very specific segment of the market or meeting a very specific need. Now, again, it doesn't matter if you're a retailer, a hotel chain, a bookstore, a day spa, or a freelance writer. If you're in business, nothing matters until you've clearly identified and communicated your positioning. And I say that because the natural tendency with freelancers and with many small business owners is to get the positioning out of the way as quickly as possible, so they can begin doing the selling, right, getting clients in the door. We all want clients as quickly as possible, and we think that if we just hang out our shingle and put up our website, the clients will come. They'll be wowed by our experience, by our credentials or samples or clips or beautiful website design, and that's simply not the case. You know, this world does not need another freelance commercial writer. It doesn't need a new copywriter What the world really needs are freelance writers who are clear about their positioning. That way, prospects can make better decisions faster, and we, as freelancers, can spend less time selling and more time on billable work. That's another point that I'll be driving throughout this session. All right, so I want you to think about it, right? As a solo business owner, which is really what we are here, your time is your most valuable non-renewable resource. And because you're limited by your time, you cannot afford to spend too much time and energy selling prospects. Instead, you have to do as much pre-selling as possible through clear and compelling positioning, which often occurs through your website, because that's typically the first place that prospects go to. And what you want is a website and communication so when prospects inquire about your services, they've already been pre-sold to a certain extent on you, and you don't have to do all the heavy lifting at that point. We have a family friend in West Virginia who recently retired after managing Kroger grocery stores for over 30 years, and I was talking to him recently about product assortments in the stores, and the conversation turned to the deli department and the challenges of managing that kind of perishable inventory. And I asked them if they carried Boar's Head brand deli meats, which is pretty much a standard here where I live in the Atlanta area. And he quickly told me that there's just no way they could make that product work in their West Virginia stores. Now, if you're not familiar with that brand, Boar's Head is typically, I'm guessing, 30% or more higher in price than the mainstream brands. And that kind of price, that premium price, that difference, works in the suburbs of Atlanta where I live, which is a fairly affluent area compared to many parts of the country. People here want that kind of quality. They have the incomes to support it, and they're willing to pay for it. But in West Virginia, just more rural, and the incomes are not there to support that kind of purchase, Boar's Head would just not sell. Now, his customers are not pre-sold on that brand, right? So trying to sell the advantages of that product right there at the deli counter, could you imagine that, right? That the deli person, the deli clerk, trying to sell the advantages of paying 30% more for Boar's Head, I mean, it would be pointless. It would be frustrating. It would be unprofitable. And it's the same thing with a freelance writing business. Trying to convert the unconvertible is a dangerous strategy. This idea, I find it really makes sense to people when I explain it this way. I see a lot of heads nodding when I teach this concept at a live workshop, on-site workshop. But when you look at freelance writer websites, you see something very different. It's usually a combination of one or two or more of these core ideas. A lot of people are positioning themselves by saying things like, my words will help you do yada, 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 or I'll write anything for anyone, anytime, for any budget. And by the way, I actually read that almost verbatim at somebody's website a couple of months ago. You might see something like, I'm a journalist, so I can do a better job than your average writer. Or, let me tell you why you need strong copy, that kind of message. And here's the thing, as a prospect looking for a writer, none of these ideas hook me on why you're uniquely positioned to help me solve my specific challenges. So let's talk about that. How do you get the right positioning? How do you communicate that? How do you pick the right positioning for you? Well, for our purposes, positioning is going to be about defining four different things: what you do, for whom, why you're different, and why that difference matters to your prospects and clients. Now, your positioning should also include one or more credibility elements that answer the inevitable prospect question, why should I believe or trust you? Usually those credibility elements are obvious when you describe the four elements that I just listed here, but sometimes you have to state either all of them or some of them outright. Now, also for our purposes, your positioning will be written from the point of view of what you'll be offering your clients, which is not necessarily focused on what you've done in the past. So in other words, it's about what you're capable of delivering, not necessarily about what you've delivered or done in the past. So don't freak out if you have little experience with certain types of projects, or if you don't think you'd like to take your business in a very different direction that interests you. What truly matters at this point is your overall track record and experience as a professional, not necessarily where you've focused on over the past few years. Now, something else I need to clarify is a language I'll be using here and throughout this class. Probably the most common term used when talking about positioning is the word niche, as I mentioned earlier, right? You read a lot about picking your niche, deciding on a niche, being clear about your niche. I don't mind this word. In fact, I use it quite frequently in my articles and my podcasts. But for our purposes here, we're going to be using more specific terminology, and I'm going to try to stick to the following terms: target market and specialty. I think these are more descriptive and they're more accurate. So target market refers to a group of prospects you can best serve, and there are many ways to slice that, one of the most common being industry. That's what most people think of when they think of target market. But I got to tell you, industry is not the only way to look at your target market. There are other attributes to consider. You can look at things such as demographics, psychographics, common desires, needs, or challenges. So you can group, you know, these people many different ways. It doesn't have to be by industry. Now, for the word specialty, for our purposes, when we talk about specialty, that will refer to a type of assignment that you've chosen to focus on, if you want to go that route. So, for instance, white papers or byline articles or web copy or book ghostwriting. Again, there's no right or wrong here. You do not need to focus on a particular industry, and you do not need to have a specialty. But you should have a well-defined target market if you want to improve your business in a big way. And again, a target market is simply a group of prospects you can best serve. That's all it is. And here's why you need to define one or more target markets you want to pursue. Would you rather be a little fish in a big pond or a big fish in a little pond? I don't know about you, but I would rather be the big fish in a little pond. Now, many freelancers avoid specificity when talking about the target market because they don't want to miss out on any potential work. But I got to tell you, that is a myth. You know, there's more work out there than you and I could ever handle in a lifetime. And as counterintuitive as it sounds, it's better to narrow your target market and stake your claim. Because when you do that, the prospects that are a good fit for you will be much more committed. They'll be much more pre-sold, and everything else being equal, they're going to be much easier to work with. So in other words, you're going to get more and better quality clients when you narrow your field than you would when you try and be all things to everyone. And here's a little secret. Just because you staked your claim doesn't mean that you won't have variety in your clients and in your work. That's a common misconception. That's another one. You'll still get a wide variety of work, but you won't have to convince those clients to hire you. They'll already come ready to do that. And I'll give you an example from my own freelance business. So for years, it was very clear on my website about whom I served, and I was very focused on the enterprise software market. But that was the target market for me. Notice in my case, it was industry specific. And most of my samples were of software companies in the ERP, data management, and construction software markets. But I had several prospects from other industries come to me over time to write their white papers or other marketing materials. And they were either recommended by one of my clients, or they stumbled on my website and saw something in my approach that they really found attractive. Whatever the reason, the great thing about those scenarios is that when they did happen, I was able to choose the clients and projects that sounded interesting to me, and I carefully selected the assignments that I thought I could do well, and that gave me the variety that I needed to keep my work interesting. So I wasn't necessarily tied to what I stated on my website was my target market. I'll give you one example real quick. In fact, this has been, it wasn't the latest one, but this is probably the one that stands out the most. There was a division of Kaiser Permanente that sells employee wellness programs to Fortune 1000 companies, and their marketing director found me online and pursued me to write some white papers for her because she really liked my work. And I told her, I said, look, I don't know your industry. I've never written for your industry. But, you know, she just felt that my ability to craft a compelling argument transcended this lack of industry background. So she hired me anyway. She hired me for two white papers and some other miscellaneous projects, and it worked really well. It was a great client to have. All right, so here's what we're going to do for the most of the balance of the class. We're going to dissect each of these four core elements of your positioning. In fact, we're going to go pretty deep into each one of them, and we're going to go through them in order, starting with the what you do and the for whom elements of your position. So remember, we're talking about what you do, for whom, why you're different, and why that difference matters. So let's take the first two, what you do and the for whom element. These two are the factors that define your target market when you think about it, right? What and for whom, what you do and who you do it for. What refers to the type of writing or writing assignments you take on, and the for whom refers to the types of clients for whom you do that work. So let's start with what, because this is the simplest element of your positioning. And when it comes to defining your what, you want to look at factors such as the types of assignments, copy versus content, or the type of writing, you know, that you want to do, or both. You know, maybe it doesn't really matter. Short versus long. And again, it doesn't really matter here, but these are ways to look at it. And then any other assignment attributes that you can think of. And we're going to go through an exercise later in the session that's going to pinpoint your ideal what, or it's going to at least show you how you can pinpoint that. So don't worry about this right now. You don't have to make decisions at this point. For now, you just need to know that you're going to want to define this in your web copy and in your prospect conversations, because your what is absolutely important, even though it's probably the easiest element, and it doesn't need to be super specific. So you don't have to say, well, I write case studies, or I only write short form copy. You know, it can be more general, but you should be mindful of your what. Next is the for whom. And I found that the for whom part of your positioning tends to create much more anxiety than the what. So we're going to spend more time on this one. And again, this is important because the days of just being a writer, just a kind of a general writer, those days are gone, at least if you want to earn a handsome income and if you want to have a much more balanced lifestyle at the same time. As I mentioned earlier, this does not mean that you have to declare an industry niche or target market. It just means that you have to define a target market that's true to you and to your specific situation. So to make the right decision, let me walk you through the four key factors to consider when deciding on your for whom. And again, we're going to go through a detailed exercise later on this, so don't worry about trying to take all this down or making a decision right now. But I got this in your handout as well, so you can reference it there as I walk through it. So there are four key factors to consider when making that for-home decision, and it's important that you treat each of them with great care. The first one is your passions and talents. And by that, I'm talking about topics you care about or find interesting. They can be personal. They can be business passions. I'm talking about fields and passions and topics where you already have a good amount of knowledge. I would urge you to start there. This is a good starting place. We're going to go through, again, that exercise later. It's going to delve deeper into this, but I just want to talk about each of these four core areas. You'll then want to start thinking about where you already have relationships. So where are your contacts today, both personal and professional? How strong are those contacts? How many of those are good connectors? And connectors matter because these are people who could really put you in touch with the right person. So it's not always who do you know directly who could hire you. It's who do you know who knows a lot of people who could potentially hire you, and how good are they in introducing you to other people. So relationships matter because, well, you know, frankly, they've never been this important in the world of business. And very often, some of our best opportunities can come from the people we know, again, even if we can't see it at the moment. One of the most pivotal moments of my career came as a result of a very casual conversation that I had with someone, and this is about 14 years ago, someone who I would have never imagined could put me in touch with the absolute best contact that I could ever have. It just transformed my career. It's what got me to where I am today. This guy, I would have never guessed, could have really connected me in that way. But he happened to know someone who was exactly the person I needed to talk to at that time to shift my career in the right direction. The third area is perceived value and financial capability. So as a potential target market starts emerging from thinking more about your passions and knowledge, interests, and talents, right, that first category, as well as a closer inventory of the people you know, this third factor is all about the value of your writing to that potential target market. So in other words, how important is the type of writing you do? Is it important enough for them to compensate you well? Or do they treat your writing, your type of writing, as more of a commodity than an investment with a high potential return? Also, what's their financial capability to pay according to the value they see in your work? So in other words, if they see great value in your product and your services, can they pay you accordingly? Let me give you a quick example, and then we'll get into some specific indicators to look for when evaluating for potential target market. So let's say that your neighbor teaches swimming classes for children at the local neighborhood pool every summer. And she does this for fun, for some extra money. If she might only do 4 or 5 sets of lessons every season, each with no more than 4 kids. Lessons are $80 per child, so her total take each summer is somewhere around $1,000 to $1,500. She comes to you because she wants to create a simple website to promote her lessons, and she wants to know what you charge her to write the copy. Now, considering that her total profits from this venture are no more than $1,500 per year, how do you think she would react to your $750 quote to do this work? Not very well, huh? Well, let's switch it around a little bit. Let's say that she and her husband travel around the city all summer long doing swimming lessons in neighborhood pools all around your city. And you live in a big city of 6 million people. They're now bringing in about $7,000 a month in income from May through September, their busy season. And then after that, they hit the indoor aquatic centers and the gyms, the indoor gyms, for the rest of the year. And then they bring, during those off months, they bring $4,000 a month. So $7,000 during the high months, $4,000 during the low months. So how would that impact their desire and ability to pay you well for the job? Especially considering that, let's say, that most of their potential customers visit their website to learn more about their approach before enrolling their children in one of their lessons. So here's another example. Say you come across a very specialized consulting firm that goes after big box retailers around the world to help them save 20% or more of their energy costs across their stores. And the typical client engagement runs anywhere from, let's say, $500,000 to $1 million. And let's say that assuming they need a series of 3 white papers to help them market these consulting services, do you think this client would be willing to pay the right writer $3,000 to $5,000 per white paper, considering the value of their engagement? Right? I bet they would. So here's what you need to do. For what are the markets for both perceived value in your work and a market's ability to pay well? Well, first, you want to consider the offerings. By offerings, I'm talking about products, services, and solutions of companies in that market. And the way to ask yourself, the way to find out, okay, well, you know, is this industry or is this category or is this sector willing to pay? You know, do they value it? Here's what you need to ask yourself. Is what they're selling new or different, expensive, and expensive for their typical customers, and complex? The reason you want to look at these factors is because products, services, or solutions that are new, different, expensive, and or complex don't just sell themselves. They're often what are called considered purchases. We'll talk more about that in a little bit, that involve a formal buying process. They involve several decision makers and a lot of content, a lot of marketing content from the vendor. And that's content that someone needs to write. So the other thing you need to ask yourself, besides the new, expensive, or complex questions, is do the market's typical offerings address an urgent or very important need or desire for their own customers? And you can answer that by looking at the products or services they sell to their customers. If these offerings are tied to things like revenue generation or profit improvement, risk mitigation, growth, their mission, a strong core desire or goal, then their offerings probably fall in the urgent or very important category. So, again, I'm just really talking about looking at their products. Did those products or services address an urgent or very important need for the customers they're going after? And the reason this is important is, again, when a business or organization needs to market something that solves an urgent or a very important problem for their customers, they're going to be much more willing to invest in content or copy to help market or sell those offerings. So let's go back to the earlier example of the individual swim instructor doing this more as a hobby than as a business. So are her services new, expensive, or complex? No, I don't think so. But what about urgency? Does she help fulfill an urgent or very important need for her potential customers? Well, Maybe. I mean, in most cases, parents are going to consider these lessons to be important, but maybe not urgent. So you have many factors pointing to kind of a low level of financial value or financial capability to pay you, which doesn't really bode well for you. What about the second scenario, the one where it wasn't a single person, it was a husband and wife team teaching swimming classes? Here again, their offerings are not new, they're not expensive or complex, but what if instead of kind of the standard fare, they used a proprietary proven system to teach older kids who are non-swimmers how to banish the fear of water and develop competence by the second session? Well, that might fall under the new/innovative category, right? And if the lessons were expensive, that's another big plus. And also, what do they market to parents who have spent years trying many different swim schools or camps with no success? And then what if the child is now entering an age where it gets harder and harder to learn to swim without being overly fearful? So here again, all those factors point towards higher value, which makes them better candidates from a financial standpoint alone. And by the way, notice how these folks are actually defining a specific target market for themselves, these swim instructors, right? So in the other example, the one with a consulting firm that helps retailers lower their energy costs, the factors are more clear-cut, right? So their offerings are probably new or innovative, for sure. They're definitely expensive. Remember, I told you their typical engagement was $500,000 to $1 million. And their approach is probably complex enough that it needs to be explained. Now, does it solve an urgent or very important need for their customers? Oh, absolutely, right? Energy savings across hundreds of stores around the world? Yeah, you bet. So this example scores very high in the financial value and financial capability area of choosing a target market. All right, here, let's talk about the fourth area here, the for whom. And it's what I call personal client attributes. It's really important that you consider attributes that might play a role in how happy you are working in a particular target market, specifically the attributes of the people you'd be working with directly. Now, I'm sure you'll agree that in this business, it's a lot more fun to work with people who not only value your work, but also respect you as a person. They're fun to work with. They jive with your personality. They make the work experience that much better, even when the pay is not as good as might be with other clients. So the ideal target market for you is one where all these factors meet. Okay, now that we're bringing all four of these together, right, your passions, knowledge, talents, your contacts, perceived value, financial capability, and then the personal attributes. In a perfect world, you're going to be able to find the intersection of all four of these factors quickly and easily, right? And while that does happen occasionally, I said in a perfect world, and it's not a perfect world. I find that most freelancers use this more as a guide than as a go, no-go litmus test. So what I mean by that is that there's actually a sweet spot you can focus on that includes but is not limited by that bullseye, that pure perfect intersection of all four factors, okay? And the key is to pick a target market that's somewhere in or around this sweet spot. Now, in reality, this sweet spot is moldable, and it can bend in any direction that carries the most weight for you. So, for instance, say that working with clients who have the right personal client attributes is super important to you, much more than their willingness or capability to pay high fees for your work. Well, because you'd rather work with people who are fun, who are passionate, they're driven by something you admire, than to give that up for a higher income. In that case, then, your sweet spot will be kind of skewed in that direction, as it should, right? Now, I'm not suggesting that these are mutually exclusive attributes. It doesn't mean that if you want to work with amazing clients, you have to give up the income part. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that you should give some thought to how you would choose when faced with competing attributes. And we're going to revisit that sweet spot idea later. But in the meantime, I want to go ahead and get to the meat of this class, which is the exercise. And this is an exercise that's very, very important. If you do one thing out of this class, I hope you take this. I urge you to take the time to go through this, to give this some thought. It's really going to give you some amazing clarity into the right niche for you, which, again, I really like to prefer to focus on target market and specialty. And there's great value in writing down your answers, by the way. So don't just think about the questions in your head and answer them in your head. I really want you to write these out, and I want you to take your time. I'm going to walk through the questions first, and then I'm going to show you how to find meaning in your answers. So let's start with the what, because, again, we're going to go through all those four core positioning areas. What, for whom, why you're different, why that difference matters. So let's start with the what. First question, again, you don't have to answer these now. This is something I want you to do later. What type of commercial writing or copywriting do you really enjoy? And by the way, if you're absolutely new, let's say you're just launching your business, do your best. I want you to just answer your question based on what you think you would like or what you think would be ideal for you. Okay, that's actually going to be good enough. So if some of these questions would only make sense if you've already been in business, don't worry about it. Just pretend you are already in business. What would it make sense for you? Okay. So again, what type of commercial writing or copywriting do you really enjoy or think you'd enjoy? You know, content, copy, some other type of writing, long format, short format, other factors. Okay. So give that some thought. Number two, what specific writing assignments do you like the most or think you'd like the most? Number three, which assignments feel easier to do? In other words, what type of work feels almost effortless when you get into it? Number four, are there any assignments that sound fascinating, yet you've never had a chance to work on them before? What are those? And what is it about them that sounds fascinating to you? Number five, what types of writing assignments do you dislike? So are there any that you absolutely hate? And if so, why? You know, this is a really good question because I think it gives you a counterpoint to all the other questions so far, and it's going to give you some more clarity as to what you might be best suited for. All right, let's move into your for whom. And again, there are four key areas for you to consider in this for whom category, starting with passions, knowledge, and talents. So let's talk about the questions and their passion, knowledge, and talents. Number one, consider those passions, knowledge, and talents. What are they? You know, again, personal, professional, business, it doesn't really matter. Put them all in here. If you want to divide them into two different columns, that's fine. Number two, what topics do you know very well? So this is more about knowledge, not necessarily passion. What have you written about extensively, at least more than the average writer? In what industries have you written? In what subject matter do you have particular expertise or experience? What type of writing do you do well? You know, what projects and topics tend to generate the most compliments from your clients and your colleagues? Number six, what topics are you passionate about? Number seven, I want you to take this one step further. I want you to imagine that you've just inherited a $20 million fortune this week, so you no longer have to write for money. In that situation, what kind of commercial writing or copywriting would you focus on? What topics? After you've taken a trip around the world, after you've bought, you know, a bigger house and a nicer car, whatever you're going to do, after you've given a bunch of that away to charity, now that you really have a choice, what kind of writing would you focus on? What topics would you like to write about? All right, the second area of the positioning, remember, contacts and relationships. So look at your personal and professional contacts. And for this, I really encourage you to open your address book or your contact management system, your Rolodex. If you're old like I am, I don't really have a Rolodex anymore, and create a list of where your best contacts work. So their industries, the fields they work in, the organizations they work in, and see if you start noticing any patterns. You know, see if you start seeing several groups or clusters. Also, pay particular attention to the contacts who seem to be good connectors. Remember I mentioned connectors earlier? Again, these are people who know a lot of other people and are very good at connecting other people together, people who should connect. And you know who those are, right? As I describe this, you're probably thinking, oh, yeah, you know, I know Barry's really good. He knows a lot of people, and he's always good about, you know, putting me in contact with others or putting others in contact with other people where it makes sense. Highlight those. Pay attention to those. And I just included a memory jogger to guide you through this effort. I'm not going to include every possibility here, but I find that, you know, if you don't have your address book handy or if it's too long or too big, start jogging your memory this way, you know, with current and previous employers. your spouse or other family member and their current or previous and or previous employers, people you've worked with in the past, people you know through church or other groups or through your kids' schools or organizations or sports teams, whatever. So there's a whole memory jogger here that I think will help you start listing people who you can start identifying and maybe clustering into different areas. Now, I want to emphasize something here. You're looking for quality. You're not looking for quantity. So this is not about, you know, the person with the biggest network wins. Okay, I've had coaching clients that worked in hot industries. They use an incredible amount of marketing content and marketing copy, but they had a really difficult time getting going because the contacts they had were not high quality. I've also had coaching clients who worked in industries that don't use a lot of outside writers, yet they were so well connected in these industries that they were able to launch a successful writing business incredibly fast. I'm thinking of someone particularly that I've been in touch with this week. She's done an amazing job. She, you know, and it's not that she knew that many people. Again, it was just the people she did know. She was really good about staying in touch with them and reconnecting with them. And then she'll even go to networking events that are very targeted. And she does an incredible job of just connecting with people and asking the right questions, being interested in them, and just starting some dialogue. So, again, it's not about quantity. It's about the quality of people. The third area, this for whom puzzle, remember, the perceived value and financial capability, their ability to pay you for the work. So start your search by looking back at your answers above in the areas of knowledge, passions, talents, and interests, as well as your personal and professional contacts. So this is not something you'll be able to do now, but once you're going through this exercise, hopefully in the next few days, and you've gotten to this point, instead of just, you know, thinking through industries, look at your answers from those first two categories, from your answers to the questions on knowledge, passions, talents, and interests, and the questions about who you know, right, who's in your network, and look at those clusters and see if you can find instances of products, services, or solutions or offerings that are new or different, expensive, and complex. You're looking for at least two out of those three in order to make that market kind of financially viable, okay? As I explained earlier, those products and services solutions that are new, different, expensive, or complex don't just sell themselves. They're considered purchases. They involve a buying process, decision makers, and a lot of content from the vendor, and that's content somebody needs to write. So that's why I'm having you think through as you look at different people. You know, as you look at some of the areas that you have a passion on, I urge you to ask yourself, okay, you know, the organizations that sell that or market this, you know, is it new, expensive, complex? You know, does it need to be sold? Are they selling something or marketing something that's a considered purchase? So here are your questions. Number one, if you're familiar with industries, markets, or organizations, or if you know people in those areas that have these qualities, list them here, okay? And number two, as you look at the list above, which ones seem to sell those products or services or solutions that are perceived as urgent or very important by your customers as opposed to just nice to have? So I'm doing two things here. I'm having you identify organizations that sell products and services that are new, expensive, or complex, and I'm also having you look at a different layer of that, which is, you know, is what they're selling considered urgent or very important by their own customers as opposed to kind of a nice-to-have thing. And again, a great way to make this determination is by looking at the products and services they sell to their customers and looking to see if those products and services are tied to things like revenue generation, profit improvement, risk mitigation, growth, mission. And what I mean by mission is, like, especially if you're going after nonprofits or schools or things like that, you know, they're not there to make money. They're there to further their mission. So if it's directly tied to furthering that mission, you know it's mission critical. You know it's highly important. It's going to be urgent or very important. So let's go back to the earlier example of the swimming instructors, because I know this, again, this can be a little fuzzy, and I've probably lost a couple of you right now, but stay with me. So remember those swimming instructors, the husband and wife team. What if, besides everything I've already told you about them, they were also professional coaches for ultra-competitive high school swimmers who were very serious about developing an edge and improving their performance at swim meets in competitions. How does that change the perceived value of their offering to someone with that kind of goal or aspiration, right? It probably does quite a bit. Let's look at the other example of the consulting firm that helps those larger retailers reduce their energy costs across all their stores. In an environment like we're in right now of rising energy costs, thinner profit margins, how important is that kind of value proposition? And compare that to a company that sells, let's say, electrical wire and conduit, right? How, do you see the difference? Just night and day difference there. Everything else being equal, the market that sells products or services that have a higher perceived value will be better targets for you as a writer from a financial standpoint alone. They can have greater need for content, for copy, and they'll be much more willing to pay higher fees. Now, if you didn't come up, as you go through this exercise later, if you don't come up with any markets that fit this criteria based on your knowledge, experience, passions, or contacts, then work backwards and think of markets that do have many of these qualities and that you can at least find somewhat interesting. So run through the, at that point, run them through the litmus test above and see if you discover some possibilities. And then lastly, the last area of the for whom equation is the personal client attributes. Now, you really here want to get clear on the types of people you can work with. And you may not be able to determine much about someone by the market in which they work or the organization they're a part of. But when you have that initial conversation with a prospect, you want to be able to assess that individual and how closely they match the attributes of your ideal client. So the first question here is think about the people you've enjoyed working with the most, the people you wish you could clone as clients. How do they treat you? You know, what are their attitudes towards you and your work? And again, if you're just now launching your business, pretend, you know, like if you had your ideal client, you know, what would they look like? What would they be like? Now, for contrast, let's look at the other side of the spectrum. Think about the people you dislike working with the most. How do they treat you? What were their attitude towards you, towards your work, right? That's very important. Again, it's going to give you some nice contrast. All right, let's move into the why you're different, which is the third part of the positioning formula. Now, before you start thinking through your differentiators, I want you to ask yourself, what do you think clients value in a freelance writer or copywriter? So if you yourself hired commercial writers or copywriters, what qualities would you look for? And I've listed some ideas here. You know, no hand-holding required, quick turnaround, error-free work. You can read the list yourself. You know, professional, trustworthy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so I really want you to give that some thought before you start thinking about what makes you different. And I'll come back to this later. This is important. You'll see why. Okay. Next, describe what makes you as a writer and as a professional different. Not your work, you. So what makes you a better choice than most of your competitors? And this is where I really want you to take your time. Again, some ideas to get you thinking. I've listed these in the handout. Background, career accomplishments, experience, skills, certification, achievements, your track record, client roster, aptitudes. Yeah, I want you to really take inventory of what you have going for you in each of these areas. And again, take your time. In some cases, your biggest differentiators aren't the ones you thought would be the strongest. Also, please remember that the idea here is not necessarily to figure out why you're different from everyone. That's a common mistake out there. Your goal is to describe what makes you different from most, or at least from many. So in my case, I decided to highlight both my sales experience and my software industry background when I was doing this. Now, does that make me the only writer in the world with those attributes? Absolutely not. I know other people who have a very similar background and can say the same thing and are saying the same thing. But, it, you know, it's been different enough to stand out with many of my prospects because at least the people they were looking at or they had worked with in the past, they really didn't come across somebody who had that, you know, unique set of skills. So list those differentiators here when you go through this exercise later. Next, question number three in this area, I want you to get some outside feedback. Now, I know some of you have done this before. I've taught this approach or this suggestion in other classes that you may have been a part of. So if you have this already, if you've done this in the past year or so, you can use the answers that you've gotten before. But if you haven't done this, I really urge you to do this. And what you're going to do is you're going to email 5 to 7 friends or colleagues or clients or even past or dormant clients, people you've known for at least 2 or 3 years. And you're going to send them the following message. And I have it here verbatim in the handout. Let me just read it real quick. Hi, Jack. I'm working with a business coach, and one of my assignments is to get feedback on the following question from a handful of people who know me well. What do you see as my unique capability? In other words, what do I naturally do better than most other people you know? Not looking for a ton of detail here, just a few sentences. I need to buy next blank. You know, give them the deadline if possible, and I would give them 3 to 5 days. Thanks in advance. I'd like you to do this. If you haven't done it before, I'd like you to do this as quickly as possible, today, tomorrow. And that way you can start getting replies in the next 2-3 days, and you can start compiling some of their answers. And I got to tell you, this exercise has been one of the most powerful things I've done in a long time because, it confirmed some of the things that I suspected, but it also added a new dimension that I wasn't aware of, and it clarified some things for me that have had a deep impact on my business over the past year or so. So I urge you to take some time to send out these emails. It really is that important. And don't be shy about asking colleagues, friends, clients for this kind of feedback. I'll tell you, most people are really happy to do this. And if possible, try to pick kind of a diverse group of people, you know, people from different areas of your life. So from a previous job, you know, a couple of past clients, people you know from church or some other group, from other outside activities, longtime friend or two, that sort of thing. You know, so if you can diversify it a bit, that's great. But if it's more concentrated in one area or the other, that's fine as well. Here's what you're going to do. When you have a few of the replies, you're going to start noticing some patterns. So some of your responses are going to start sounding similar. And I want you to pay attention to those patterns. It's a good thing if you do get that repetition. And you just start clustering those. Consolidate those into themes. So I'll give you an example. When I did this exercise, there were 3 specific themes that emerged. There were others, but these are 3 that really stood out for me. Number 1, I have a gift for breaking down information into logical sequences and then synthesizing that information into something useful. I have a gift for understanding and developing powerful marketing strategies. And I have a gift for analyzing, decoupling, and solving complex problems. So what I did is I just noticed those. And as I, now, that's my language combined with the language of the people who reply to me. But, you know, those are 3 themes that really stood out for me. And, you know, it's not necessarily the kind of thing that you'll be able to apply directly into your positioning, your messaging. But, again, it's going to give you that added dimension that could maybe add a little bit of clarity to what you've already uncovered during your self-discovery process, or it might add some things that you could really copy verbatim and use in your own communications. So it really depends. And look, if anything, worst case scenario, you're going to feel really, really good about yourself when you're done with this, when you get these answers. So at a minimum, even if you don't feel you can use any of this in your positioning or in your messaging or your website, you're going to have something. And I'll tell you, I did this. I printed those email responses, and I put them in a folder. A couple times a year, I pull that out, read it. It really makes me feel wonderful. So you'll have something there that's kind of an emergency file you can turn to when you're really feeling down. Okay, so then the final step is you want to consolidate all your differentiators. So I want you to review responses from your questions and from the outside feedback, and narrow things down to your strongest 3 to 6 differentiators, and then list them here. All right, let me just take a quick drink of water, guys, and we'll continue. All right, so the final step of the positioning is that why it matters, why that difference matters, right? And what you're going to do is for each differentiator in your consolidated list in the last question above, you want to explain why it matters, and you're going to do that by matching it to what your clients need. Remember earlier you started listing things you think your clients really look for in a freelance writer or copywriter? And it was a guess, but it's probably a really good guess. So now what you're going to do is you're going to match your differentiators to some of those requirements or needs or expectations. So let's say that you listed someone who can hit the ground running quickly is one of the attributes you feel your clients or clients would really value in a writer. And then you listed 8 years experience in the commercial insurance industry as one of your differentiators. Well, what you want to do is you want to match these two by explaining why the differentiator matches a client need. So you could say, well, the fact that I have 8 years' experience in the commercial insurance industry means that I can hit the ground running and tackle your projects with no hand-holding. Okay? So essentially what you want to do is ask yourself the following question about each differentiator you've listed, in that consolidated list of 3, 4, 6, 7 differentiators. What? So what? Why does that matter? And specifically, why would that differentiator matter to a potential client, right? So when in doubt, just keep asking yourself, so what? You know, this is a differentiator. So what? Why does that matter? You know, why would that matter to a potential client? All right, so putting it all together, I've given you a lot of questions, which, is, again, it's going to require some serious thinking. So let me just recap how I would approach this process. I want you to start with, follow this in order, start with the what questions. That's usually the easiest area to define and get clear on, and you know, it's easier to develop momentum with those easier questions. Then the for whom area will require the most thinking, so you're going to go there next. And these questions are already in order, so you don't have to really overthink this. Just kind of follow that order. Go through the questions in the order I listed them, and you know, so start thinking about your skills, your knowledge, your passions, talents, and let that kickstart the process further. Next, move into the questions about the people you know. That will help you see potential opportunities in terms of the people who could help you. It'll help you cluster people based on the organizations they're in, the types of organizations, industries, businesses, other attributes. And that's also a good segue into the next area. So with the financial capability stuff, again, rather than creating a random laundry list of industries or markets to explore, start your search by looking back at your answers in the areas of knowledge, passions, talents, and interests, as well as your personal and professional contacts. And let those answers guide your brainstorming efforts. So in other words, don't list software or medical devices and green technologies as potential target markets for you just because you're trying to come up with industries you feel can pay really well. Instead, let your own answers to the questions about passions, knowledge, and contacts guide that brainstorming effort. Number 5, don't discount the personal attribute questions. Those are very important. And again, they're going to give you the clarity you'll need when you start talking with potential clients and you're trying to determine if the person feels like a good fit for you on a personal and professional level. And then finally, number 6, move to the why you're different and why that matters questions. And make sure to keep asking yourself, so what, for every differentiator that you've listed. So the bottom line here is you want to go through this process methodically in the order that I've listed it here, the questions, and the order I've listed them. Don't jump around. Now, for many of you, the decision on a target market is not going to be very straightforward. I mean, you're going to have to give this some thought, and even once you have clarity in the issue, you're really going to have some decisions to make. I've found that most people weigh some of these 4 areas higher than the other in terms of those 4 factors on the for whom, which is your target market, right? In my case, when I launched my freelance business, I placed a greater weight on my contacts because I realized early on that the people who knew me well would recommend me to potential clients. At the time, I really didn't care much what I wrote about or whom I wrote for. I just wanted to get my business started, and then I could just take it from there. Now, as my business evolved, I started placing more emphasis on the financial aspect of things. I wanted to work for clients who valued the type of work I did and who were willing to pay well for it because it made more financial sense for them to do that. I also started paying more attention to personal attributes. I wanted to work with people who jived with my personality, the people who were fun to be around, people I liked, and people who respected me. Now, today I'd say that I've placed the most emphasis on perceived value and financial capability. And on a scale of 1 to 5, I would give that one a 5. Next, I care about personal attributes. So I would also give that one a 5. I would also weigh passion, knowledge, and talents fairly high, but maybe more as a 3 because, I mean, honestly, I have a wide range of interests. I'm willing to write about many different areas of technology or business in general. And then I would weigh contacts as a 4, just because I prefer to work with clients who come recommended by people I know, but not quite a 5 because it's not a must, but it's definitely up there. So what I encourage you to do, and I have a diagram of this here in your handout in the class notes, I encourage you to use this weighted approach, if you will, in your decision. I don't think this is a decision you can make in a purely scientific way, but if you're really torn, try assigning each of these four areas a score between 1 and 5. So a score of 1 means that this area is really not that important to you, or there's nothing there that would help you get to where you want to go. Conversely, a score of 5 means that this area is extremely important to you, or you have something very valuable you can leverage there in that area. Now, as you can see from the visual representation of where all the scores would fall under each category, this approach that I just described starts breaking down if you give all categories a weight of 1 or a weight of 5, but obviously that's not the idea here. You know, if you gave each one a weight of 1, you'd end up in the bullseye, and if you gave each one a weight of 5, then your sweet spot would be too large. So make sure to weigh each category honestly, and then let the weights guide you, right? Use the results to think about your final answer, not necessarily to arrive at your final answer. I don't think it's going to, like, you know, again, kind of spit out an answer for you. This is the kind of decision you got to make kind of in a more creative fashion. I think this is just a way to guide your final decision. So just so you can see why this approach can help, let me give you a couple of ways to show this visually. So the first image here in the notes is that of a basic sweet spot that I described earlier. So notice that there's that bullseye in the middle, which is, you know, the perfect world, the perfect situation. Some people do find that. But then there's a larger area around it that's completely acceptable, and that's a sweet spot. Now, in my case, the sweet spot is a bit skewed. It's not quite as perfect as you see in that first image. And my sweet spot is more like what you see on the second image. Notice that it's skewed more towards the financial part, personal attributes, and contacts, and not so much towards passions, knowledge, and talents. Okay. Now, here are some pointers to make sure you choose well as you go through this process and once you've gone through the exercise and you're trying to mull this over. First of all, choose wisely. You know, make sure your chosen target market is big enough to support you and clear enough to attract the right prospects. Also, don't go too narrow at first. So try to resist the temptation to go too narrow in terms of target market specificity. I think it's safer to go down just enough in specificity to separate yourself from the crowd, but not so narrow that you drastically limit the size of your prospect base. What's going to happen is over time, you're going to be able to go narrower as you get a better feel for the nature of your chosen market. So, for instance, I went from offering to write anything for anyone when I started out in 2003 to specializing in the high-tech industry. Now, high-tech industry is still a huge market, but it was narrow enough to make a big difference in my ability to attract great clients and to differentiate myself. So, and what happened is over time, I started narrowing down things a bit in that target market. And so rather than just saying high-tech, I started saying, well, software companies. And then I felt more comfortable being more specific in my copy and in my marketing materials. I started getting into, well, I specialize in data management, ERP, or construction management solutions, you know. But I did that only once I had developed a following in each of those areas and I felt comfortable enough to take a stand. There's no way I could have gotten that specific that early in the process. I went kind of narrow enough to separate myself from the crowd, and then as I learned my way through this, I became more and more specific until I had specialties or several target markets. They were very viable, very descriptive, and actually got me a ton of business. If you're a new or an aspiring freelancer, you're just getting started, you haven't even launched, or maybe you just launched, resist the temptation to be too rigid or too focused. So, for instance, unless you have extensive writing experience in case studies from your last two jobs, and corporate marketing communications, don't say I'm a case study writer and that's all I do. Don't be that rigid. Instead, you know, be more flexible. It's okay to pick 1, 2, or 3 main project specialties, but don't be so rigid unless there's a very good reason for you doing so. Instead, do what I call follow the flow. So tap your personal and professional network. See where that leads you and be open to working on just about any writing project just to get the experience of working with a client and managing a project, and then see where that takes you. So going back to my earlier example, when I was starting out, when I chose high tech as my target market, I also said that my focus within that target market was writing lead generation materials. But something interesting started to happen when I did that. As I started talking with prospects, I found that lead generation was not something they were desperate to outsource. They would tell me things like, hey, Ed, you know, that's great about your lead generation writing, but what I really need help with right now is a white paper. Do you write white papers? And I would, of course, accept that offer. I'd say, yeah, I write white papers. And as a result, I started getting more and more of that content writing work. And before I knew it, more than 90% of my work was marketing content, not lead generation copy. So the lesson here is to stay flexible. You know, it's okay to kind of drive that stake in the ground, but let the market show you the way. You know, be flexible and make the necessary adjustments along the way. But, you know, also don't let them take you down a path that you absolutely hate or that doesn't pay well. So stay flexible and open-minded, but, you know, be mindful of where it's taking you as well. The next key point is to take your time. You know, as I mentioned several times already, you may have to let this information and you, even your answers marinate for a few days or even a week or two before the right answer emerges. So walk away from this work. You know, if you're kind of scratching your head even after you poured all the information you could into the exercise, tell yourself and tell the universe that, look, you expect good answers, that you expect clarity, and then try to forget about this material for a day or two. And what typically happens is that the answer will just kind of come out of the blue when you're taking a shower, walking the dog, or, you know, driving somewhere. Next, don't wait for perfection. And yes, you want to do this right, and you don't want to jump into conclusions too early. But at the same time, it's best to make a good enough decision and just take action on that decision than to sit around until the best solution emerges. Keep in mind that this is more of a self-discovery process than a way to arrive at a perfect set of answers. Now, I'm going to take a quick drink of water, and I'm going to walk through a bonus section that I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the class, which is, hey, once you have some really good clarity as to what your positioning is going to be, how do you turn that into some copy, because that really is the next logical step. So just give me a sec, and we'll get going with that, and then we'll go to Q&A. Okay. Now, what we're trying to do here, once you're comfortable with where you're heading and you have a clarity here, the next step is going to be turning that into copy. I mean, you want to be able to communicate that, right, especially on your website. And I found that rather than going straight from these questions into copy, it's best to stair-step your way to that. And we're going to start that process by crafting a series of very simple value statements. Now, a value statement is nothing more than a simple paragraph or even a series of bullet points that communicate your positioning. So it describes what you do, for whom, why you're different, and why that difference matters. And I found that creating a few of these value statements is a really good warm-up exercise for crafting your copy. It's a kind of a middle step that helps you get clear on this core message and then gives you some good raw material for writing that copy. I look at it as a kind of a sandbox. You know, it gives you a safe environment you can play with or play in before you make the copy live on your website. So what you want to do is you want to take your findings from the positioning exercise you just went through and start crafting some statements that encapsulate your positioning. And you can do this in one of two ways. So let me show you a couple ways. You can write them in paragraph form, or you can do it through a series of bullets. And so let me show you an example, and this is in your class notes, of the paragraph approach. I give you kind of a fill-in-the-blank template, and I give you an example of what that could look like, you know, when you're done with it. So, you know, one of the two examples is I work with software companies to write white papers, articles, and case studies that help accelerate their sales cycles. And like most business writers, I'm an 11-year software sales veteran, so I understand the complex strategic selling process and the critical role marketing plays in this process. So if you use – and listen, don't be tied to these. These are just some examples. This is not set in stone, but you know, this will show you some of the archetypes or the structure that you could use for these value statements. I think of value statements as kind of an internal thing, so don't strive for perfection. This is not for publication yet. Give yourself permission to sound silly. Give yourself permission to have run-on sentences. Give yourself permission to be wordy, to be choppy, whatever. You're just trying to take that raw material and turn it into something somewhat useful. Now, this paragraph approach, I think, works really well when you have some very good ideas of how you want to communicate your positioning. So if you're ready to play around with some of the elements you uncovered during the positioning exercise, give this a try. And again, feel free to try a number of different approaches and formats. I don't want you to be limited by these two. They're just examples. The other approach is much more casual, and it involves writing a series of bullet points that may not flow as well as the examples above. And this approach, the bulleted approach, works best when you're still sorting through ideas and you're trying to make sense of what you uncovered in that exercise. Now, personally, I found that I like to use the bulleted approach. For me, it just takes the pressure off trying to make your ideas flow nicely, and it allows me to focus on combining different thoughts and coming up with a variety of iterations. So, you know, even though I told you that this is the value statement is supposed to be kind of for internal use only, I think as a writer, many of us still have that inner critic that starts saying, oh, this sounds like crap. So it adds that pressure. So if you find yourself doing a lot of that, give yourself a break and try the bulleted approach. So here's some examples of what that might look like. And these are just, you know, this is just random here. But, you know, this process is kind of random. I won't read all these. These are all in your class notes. But I write white papers, case studies, and byline articles. Another bullet says, I work for enterprise software companies in the data management, WMS, and AEC space. Another one says, no hand-holding required. I'm the consummate professional. I get it done, and I get it done on time always. Another one says, on average, I work with clients for more than 2.5 years. Another one says, I'm a dependable and trusted partner, a key member of my client's marketing team. So notice they're in no particular order. They're just kind of out there, and this is a good way to just kind of throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall. And then you have something, at least on paper, you can work with. Whichever approach you pick, the important thing is to, again, not overthink it. Try not to dwell too much on coming up with a perfect combination. You're not writing copy yet. The whole point of doing this is to have that intermediary step. You know, you're trying to come up with raw statements that communicate the important elements of your positioning. Once you have at least 2 or 3 iterations you feel good about, the next steps are to, number one, come up with a list of credibility elements to include in your copy, and number two, describe your prospect's biggest challenges related to marketing communications or related to finding a good writer. So let's talk about credibility elements real quick. So your copy, as I mentioned earlier in the class, is going to need to include 1 or more credibility elements that answer that question that the prospect's going to have of, you know, why should I believe or trust you? And again, those credibility points are usually included in your messaging, in your positioning, and what you've already talked about, the what, for whom, why you're different, why it matters. But sometimes you have to state some of them outright. And here's some example potential credibility elements you could leverage. And again, these are in the class notes, so don't need to take these down. I'm not going to read them all. Experience in a particular industry, years you've been writing professionally, organizations you've worked for, degrees, awards, testimonials, problems you've helped solve, very specific or unique talent or combination of skills that you may have that's not commonly found. You've been quoted in the media. You've been interviewed, you know, so on and so forth. So it can be very beneficial to create a list of credibility elements that you can infuse into your copy. Again, some may already be part of your value statement iterations, but go ahead and come up with a laundry list of possibilities. It can't hurt, especially when you start really writing your website copy or rewriting what you already have. The next thing is you're going to want to do is something that you're going to continue from part of the exercise we talked earlier. You're going to want to write a few sentences that describe some of the biggest challenges your prospects face as it relates to either marketing communications or to finding a good writer to work with. Either way, I encourage you to write it in the second person. And I got a couple of examples here for you. So here's one. This is from my own website. Finding a copywriter who grasps your technology solutions can be a challenge. Even harder is finding a writer with street-level technology sales experience. someone with the skills to communicate your message so it resonates with your over-marketed prospects and drives action. I also have another example from my good friend and colleague, Diana Huff. I think she did a beautiful job describing the world of her target market and the challenges they face. So here again, feel free to write two or three or more iterations of these challenges. You can end up picking your very best one or two, so it pays to keep working on this until you have some really, really solid ones. All right, so that's pretty much it, guys. I mean, the real work here is not you sitting down here and taking notes. As you can imagine, the real work is taking the time and having the discipline to now go through that exercise and give it the time that it deserves. Now, if you've stayed with me so far and you've completed every step of this process, you're even starting to you know, do some of this work, you're starting to think through this, I congratulate you. You've really gone further than 95% of people who sit on this journey. But if you still feel like you could use some help through this process, if you're not sure where to go from here, I'd love to help you if I can. I'll tell you one way I can do this is I have a 10-week group coaching program called B2B Business Launcher, and it's designed specifically for B2B or commercial writers who are either trying to launch or writing businesses where they've already launched but are not really happy with the results they've achieved so far. And in this program, you and I get to work together one-on-one and in a very small group setting to make sure that your not just the ignition phase of your launch, but also the actual launch is done and done right. And we go beyond that into key strategic topics such as, you know, managing your prospecting effort more effectively, handling prospect conversations with ease, pricing your work profitably, negotiating like a pro, closing more of the projects you quote. Plus, I show you how to build on this launch foundation so that prospects start coming to you instead of you having to chase them all the time. If this sounds interesting, there's a page you can go to get on a waiting list for the next time I put this out there. I don't have a group starting right now. We'll have one starting in September, and the website is b2blauncher.com/waiting. And just get on my early notification list. You'll be the first one to know when I have spots available. So that's it. Well, look at this, an hour and 20 minutes, which is exactly what I thought where would be at this point. I'm going to go ahead and open it up for Q&A. I'm also going to check questions that have been submitted while I've been talking. And let's see. All right, I don't see any questions here so far. So here's what we're going to do, guys. If you have a question, go ahead. If you're on the webcast, go ahead and type it in, okay? And, I mean, it's really no explanation for that. Just type it in and hit submit. If you're on the phone, there's a couple people on the phone. This looks like most of you are on the webcast. All you have to do is hit *2 on your telephone keypad. I will see your hand raised, and I will unmute you, and you can ask away. So I'll wait for a couple minutes while you guys submit questions, and we'll go ahead and get to that. Okay, Mary had a question here. She wanted to know, let me see if it, because this is, she had some other comments here. All right, it looks like the question is, okay, I've been working in an industry where clients, okay, so let me just paraphrase this. She's basically saying that she's been working in an industry where clients don't really value the writing. They keep beating her down on price. And, you know, it's an issue, but she really enjoys the topic. You know, it's kind of a dilemma. You know, what should she do? So here's the thing. This is why I love going through that part of the exercise where you get to look at those four core areas of your for whom, because I think the for whom part is again, one that a lot of people ignore. They just kind of go with the flow, and it's important that you take stock of what's valuable to you. You know, you're going to have to make a decision as to, you know, okay, are there other organizations in your industry, and you didn't indicate which industry it was, Mary, but are there other organizations in your industry that would have the higher financial capability to pay, that would value your work more than the clients that you're working for right now? So only you can answer that. And I'll give you an example, just because I've worked with some people who are writers who do work for higher education, and there are some segments of the higher education market where it's really low value. You know, and many times it's because it's not directly tied to revenue generation or profitability. You know, so they don't really, and there are a lot of writers too who are trying to compete for that work. But I worked with someone recently who also works in that market, and she was able to get some really profitable work with a university that not just, you know, kind of does the traditional programs for undergrads and graduate students, but also targets Fortune 500 companies and tries to get in there to sell courses for their employees on, not just their employees, but their management team on leadership. So they have these very specific leadership programs that are very expensive. Now, the company pays for these, you know. So many companies can afford this. In fact, they have budgets to do this. But this stuff needs to be sold, and it's a competitive market, too, because there are other universities offering similar things. So she was able to get a series of very lucrative white paper gigs to sell the value of the approach that this university was taking with this course material. So notice the difference. There are elements in sectors within higher education where there's little value, or at least little perceived value. I don't want to devalue what some of you guys may be doing. Not at all, but little perceived value by the client. And there's others where there's big money to be made, and they're going after prospects with big budgets, and they're willing to pay more. So that's a perfect example of, you know, you can stay in the same industry but go into different sectors of the industry or do different types of writing within that industry where the financial piece may work a little better for you. So I wouldn't automatically assume, look, I guess I need to move out of this market. I get asked a lot about, you know, magazine writing. Well, everyone knows that magazines, newspapers, I mean, that's a very difficult field. A lot of journalists out of work. That's all they know, so they're going after the magazines. But, you know, you also hear from writers who are doing really, really well in getting, you know, just to kind of put it in perspective, $1.50, $2 a word for feature articles for some publications, you know, where a lot of people are struggling to get, you know, 50 cents a word. So there's segments in that industry that are doing well, depending on your background, the topic, what they're writing about. I've done a lot of ghostwritten features, so bylined articles. So the same publications that are paying almost nothing to freelance writers when they're creating the content themselves, the editorial themselves, are accepting guest articles from companies that aren't writing these articles themselves. They're paying a writer to write them. I've written a bunch of those, averaging, you know, $1.50, $2 a word, just to, again, to put it in perspective, not that I necessarily charge by the word. All right, let's see. Are there any other questions? Okay. Dan asks, hi, Ed. Once you've picked a niche target market, should you go all out and put that information on your website, business cards, et cetera? How do you handle it if people outside of that niche come to you for work? Yeah, great question. So, Yes, I think you should. But again, as I mentioned later on in the class, I think you need to play it safe. So the example I used was I went from saying that I'm basically a business-to-business writer, commercial writer, and that got me nowhere, to saying I am a business-to-business writer for the high-tech industry. That was important enough or significant enough to change my business. I mean, within days, it seemed like, maybe it was a couple of weeks, I had a couple of great leads because I was positioning myself differently. So notice that I declared a target market, but it was still a massive target market. So I didn't go extremely specific, but it was specific enough that I was able to carve out, you know, a narrower segment of the overall market. Now, you know, did I put that on my website? Did I kind of screen that? My website, business cards, my email signature, and all that? You betcha. I absolutely did, and I encourage you to do that. What I don't encourage you to do is, okay, I'm starting out as a generalist. That's not really cutting it. I do have all this experience in software, but you know what? I'm not just going to say high tech, which is safer. I'm going to say that I write case studies for the construction software industry. Okay. I've just really narrowed down my market, and there's probably still about, you know, a couple of hundred companies around the world who could be viable prospects for me, but that's not enough. I mean, I've really narrowed it down. I think that is way too risky. Now, I could have gotten to that same spot I told you about, case studies for the construction software industry, in a more organic way. So maybe over the course of 3 or 4 years, I find that I'm writing a lot of case studies for the construction software industry. And I like it so much, and I do so well, and I have such high demand that I decide, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and declare this highly specific target market as my niche or as my focus. Now, at that point, what am I doing? That's a safe bet, right? I have enough of a track record and experience and knowledge to know that I can do this safely and confidently. There's enough business. But notice the difference. I only did it once I knew for sure. So that's what I wanted to make sure everybody knew and understood is, hey, you know, just play it safe, and you can start narrowing down little by little as you learn more, as you feel your way through this. So the second part of Dan's question was, how do you handle it if people outside of that target market or niche come to you for work? Well, just like I did with, you know, the example I gave you with Kaiser Permanente. So here's a, you know, an insurance company, a health insurance company coming to me, massive. I got software written all over my website, very, at that point, is very specific. And she's contacting me. She wants me to write some white papers on employee wellness programs. Well, you know, I don't know that industry. I don't know that topic. But so I talked to her. I said, listen, how can I help you? And she told me, and I always ask, how did you learn about me? She says, well, I was doing some searches, and, you know, I was kind of looking for someone local if I could, and, you know, your name came across. I was looking through your website. I really like your writing style. I said, well, you know, you probably noticed that my focus is really enterprise software. I don't know your industry. She said, no, I understand that, but you know what? I was reading through your white papers. I really like your approach. I mean, if you can do that, you'll be able to understand our business and our industry really well. I don't think you're going to have any trouble at all. I mean, the question is, are you interested? And I think I told her, you know what, let me think about it and get back to you. And I did. And now that I think I did tell her I wanted to think about it because it was a new area for me, and I wasn't sure if I really wanted to pursue that. But notice the dynamic of that conversation, right? She's pursuing me, okay? That's very different, and you're going to have that, you know? It's going to happen. At that point, because they're pursuing you, you've made it clear, listen, I'm potentially interested. However, are you aware that this is not my specialty, blah, blah, and if they still want to move forward, then really it's up to you. You know, I was able to quote a premium price for this work. In fact, it's the highest that I had charged for a white paper at that time. And I did two of them for this organization. So, so the short answer is I wouldn't worry about it. it's better to declare something and be the big fish in that little pond than to say, I don't know if I want to take that chance because I might be walking away from some potential opportunities. What will happen is those other potential opportunities, some of them, and the best ones are going to be the ones that are going to come to you. And at that point, you're in a position of power, you know, and then you can really name your price in some of these cases. All right, and again, if you're on the phone, star 2 raises your hand, and I'll unmute you and you can ask away. All right, somebody indicated, and this must have been earlier in the class, that there was some noise coming through with my voice. So I'm curious to know if any of you can let me know by typing it in if it was really bad or maybe an isolated incident. I hope everything came through clearly. I'm sure I would have heard more if it had been for everybody. All right, I'll wait a few more seconds. There's a 20-second delay through the webcast, so I want to make sure I give everyone a chance to ask their questions. If there's no more, we'll wrap up. Otherwise, I'll go ahead and answer those. Somebody typed in that it was a little unclear at first, but it went away, but it sounded like a weak mariachi band. Wow, that is weird. Okay, I'll have to listen to the replay and see how bad it was. I apologize, guys. I have no idea what that might have been. It definitely wasn't on my end. I had a guy outside doing yard work with a weed whacker and all, but that was for like 1 minute. All right, I don't see any more questions, guys, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. And again, I really urge you to not just stop here. This is not the kind of class where as you can imagine by now, where you can sit back and the answers are going to kind of come to you. You have to do the work. So I urge you, make an appointment with yourself. You know, treat this as a project. Carve out, you know, an hour in the next couple of days. I think the sooner you can get started, the better. It's not about completing the whole exercise this week, but if you can do half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, sometime tomorrow, over the weekend, early next week, man, the earlier the better, and then carve yourself out another hour or two next week to really think through this and add as much detail as you can. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You know, if you guys have some breakthroughs, great. If you're stumbling through it, you know, shoot me a note. I can't promise that I can answer everybody, but I wish you the best. Listen, this is the best approach that I've found to come up with the most viable target market and specialty, okay? So, but it only works if you work it. So go through it. Guys, good luck. Thanks for attending the class, and we'll talk real soon. Remember that the class workbook will be posted tomorrow, and the replay will definitely be posted within 24 hours. Thanks so much. Take care. We'll talk soon.
The moderator has left the conference.